Chapter 25, A Question of Identity. On the afternoon of our second day of freedom, Satyapriya and I reached New Delhi, where we caught the first train to Madras. Our plan was to study Buddhism in Ceylon. Throughout the whole of the thousand-mile journey, the third-class compartment into which we had fought our way was so densely packed with passengers and luggage that each night, when we wanted to sleep, my friend and I had to scramble up onto a luggage rack of such narrow dimensions that even one of us could hardly have slept there in comfort. What with the glare of ceiling lights, the suffocating closeness of the atmosphere, and the slamming of doors, shouting of coolies, shrieking of passengers, and blowing of whistles at every station, not to speak of the excruciating discomfort of our position, we slumbered but fitfully, so that when, on the morning of the fourth day, we reached Madras, great was our relief. Though they had not been unaware of my inclinations, the Swamis of the Ramakrishna Math, Mylapore, to which we went straight from the station, were astonished to see the young Englishman who, only 8 months earlier, had visited them in a white tropical suit, now reappearing in the saffron robes of an Indian sadhu. Whether they were pleased at the sight of this sudden transformation or not, they were too subtle to allow me to discern. But they received us kindly, and after showing us round the library and dispensary attached to the Math, which Satyapriya had not seen before, left us to sleep off our weariness in the guest house, in a manner that suggested we were to be their guests for the next few days. We had time, therefore, to visit the headquarters of the Theosophical Society at Adyar, only a mile from the Math, where, from the wooded river bank, we watched the sun go down over the estuary, as well as the famous Mylapore beach, a flat 2 mile stretch of firm sand, up and down which we strolled until long after nightfall with one of the younger Swamis. Now discussing questions of religion and philosophy, now pausing to listen to the hiss of the breakers as with moonlit white crests they raced far up the beach. There were also exchanges with the President Swami, an unusually reserved and taciturn Bengali, and with the young, brilliantly intellectual editor of the Vedanta Kesari, a Travancorean with whom, as a regular contributor to the magazine, I had long been in correspondence. While the President Swami neither approved nor disapproved explicitly on the step Satyapriya and I had taken, he clearly felt misgivings. But whether on account of our youth and inexperience, or because we were going to Ceylon to study Buddhism instead of remaining in India to study Vedanta, it was difficult to be sure. Nityabodhananda, the editor, franker and more communicative, not only approved our project, but asked me a number of questions relating to Buddhist philosophy. Like most Hindus, he had been puzzled by the Anatman doctrine, the doctrine that there is in man no permanent, unchanging soul, independent of the evanescent psychic states and processes, and I therefore strove to elucidate it for him. The article which, in consequence of our discussion, he asked me to contribute to his magazine, gave rise to a controversy with an orthodox Vedantin that continued for several years. Though fellow passengers in the train had eyed us curiously from time to time, one or two of them going so far as to ply Satyapriya with questions regarding our caste and nationality, it was at Madras that we were made to realize the great change that had taken place in our status and the responsibilities which this entailed. The incident that more than any other precipitated, or at least underlined, this realization was at the time a source of great embarrassment to us. One afternoon, while we were reading at the big round table in the hall of the Math, two visitors entered. Thinking that, as people often did, they had come to pay their respects to Sri Ramakrishna's image in the shrine upstairs, We went on reading. But instead of going towards the staircase, they turned in our direction, and before we could prevent them, prostrated themselves at our feet. This they certainly did not do out of regard for our personal sanctity, for in any case they had no means of knowing who we were, what we did, or whence we had come. Their prostration was the formal expression of the respect traditionally paid to the wearer of the saffron robe. Years later, when I had mixed much with robes of all hues, and had heard notoriously unworthy members of the Buddhist monastic order justifying their claim to be treated with the utmost deference by the laity on the grounds that respect is paid to the robe, not to the wearer of the robe, I could not help wondering to what point this contradiction between appearance and reality could be carried without seriously undermining the whole structure of Buddhism. Surely it is incumbent upon the monk to respect the robe he wears by striving to be an embodiment of the ideal it represents, instead of merely demanding that the laity should show their respect for it by falling prostrate at his feet. As far as Satchapriya and I were concerned, our first experience of people making obeisance to us simply on account of our dress was not only a demonstration of the undiminished strength of Indian religious traditions, but a pertinent reminder of our own obligations. At the end of an uneventful journey from Madras down the tip of the peninsula to Dharnascuti, and thence by sea to Colombo, we met an unexpected setback. We were not allowed to land in Ceylon. In the extravagance of our zeal for world renunciation, we had destroyed all our papers and were without means of establishing our identity. Moreover, having come to the conclusion that nationalism was one of the greatest evils of the modern world, and that, in becoming homeless wanderers, we had renounced not only all domestic ties and social obligations, but all national loyalties, Satchapriya and I had vowed never to admit that we belonged to a particular nationality. To the polite but puzzled Sinhalese immigration officer who came on board to inspect the documents of the passengers, we stated that we were sadhus and that we had come to Ceylon to study Buddhism and to take, if possible, ordination as bhikshus. When he inquired our nationality, we replied that, having renounced the world, we had none. This reply, however philosophical, was of course, from the official point of view, entirely unsatisfactory. After a brief interrogation, in the course of which we reinforced our position with quotations from the Buddhist scriptures, he told us that we would have to return to India by the next boat. As the boat was not due to leave until the following morning, we asked permission to visit Colombo, but this he refused to allow. Though we eventually found it impracticable to maintain in all its uncompromisingness the attitude we had adopted, I still consider it logical and right, and though, owing to the exigencies of the modern state, accommodations have had to be made, I cannot even now feel that I owe an exclusive loyalty to any nation or race. A bhikshu, a member of the Buddhist monastic order, is, or should be, a citizen of the world, and his sole allegiance is to the Buddha, Dharma, the Sangha. As an adherent of this view, I was often saddened in later years by the blatant nationalism of some Buddhist monks who evidently felt that they were Ceylonese or Burmese first and bhikshus a very long way afterwards. The following afternoon, Satchapriya and I found ourselves back in the camp at Mandapam, where, 2 days earlier, we had been vaccinated before embarkation. The camp consisted of a few tents and hutments scattered on the loose, grassless, yellow sand among the margosa trees. Sitting in the shade cast by the dense, feathery green foliage of one of these handsome trees, the twigs of which supply the South Indian with his morning toothbrush, we reviewed our position. The collapse of our plan to study Buddhism in Ceylon did not unduly dismay us. Indeed, in the mood of spiritual exaltation which had persisted all the way from Kasauli, we felt that it might turn out to have been providential, a feeling the cooler judgment of later years confirms. But now that the road to Ceylon was blocked, where were we to go? Whose idea it was, I do not remember, but we eventually decided to take the train back to Madura, go from there to Cape Comorin, the southernmost point of the whole peninsula, and then walk from Cape Comorin to the Himalayas, a distance of nearly 2,000 miles. Wherever we happened to halt for the night, we would meditate as usual, for both of us were convinced that without regular meditation, spiritual life was meaningless. Besides testing our powers of endurance and the strength of our renunciation, the venture would have the advantage of giving us constant opportunities of intimate contact with the Indian people.